Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
On the Empire Podcast this week, we say, blimey O'Reilly, it's only Pedro Almodovar, as the great Spanish director drops by to tie us up, tie us down. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that might as well start by saying sorry and just get it out of the way early. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Fancy that. Now, before I introduce them properly, this week, we went a bit viral. You know that hashtag Fav7Films or Fave7Films? Favorite7Films. That was sweeping the Twitter machine this week. Well, that began with us. And as it happens, I have my colleagues' choices right here.
Oh, God. I dread to think. Please go on, Chris.
First up is our geek queen. A lady whose favourite seven films of all time are... Number 7, The Princess Bride. Number 6, Dragonheart. Number 5, Dragon Slayer. Number 4, Reign of Fire. Number 3, Dragon Ball Z.
Oh my gosh.
And the top two choices tied...
Uh-huh.
Sam Winchester and Dean Winchester. Those aren't even films, Helen O'Hara.
They are. They're Ingmar Bergman films. They're quite obscure. You probably haven't heard of them. This is a lie and a calumny, and I would like to disassociate myself from it entirely. Thank you. I thought so.
Lie. That was.
Yeah, lie is a complicated word that you haven't heard before. But one of those films would actually be in my top seven. Obviously, Dean Winchester.
Next up, we have our youngest pod team member, whose choices are all from the year she was born, weirdly enough. So here they are. Number 7, Twilight. Number 6, Kung Fu Panda. Number 5, Wall-E. Is that the only one? That's the weirdest pronunciation of that film ever.
Wall-E.
Number 4, Hancock. Number 3, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the what's that?
I've never heard of it.
It's weird. Don't know what that one is. Number 2, Iron Man. And number 1, The Dark Knight.
So 2008.
Boom. Emma Thrower.
You're 20 years too late, but okay.
But there you go.
I appreciate this.
It's the only way to explain that you hadn't seen Die Hard.
But I have not.
Or The Princess Bride.
I know, I was going to say Helen's List. I've seen none of those.
You haven't seen Dragon Ball Z?
I've not seen Dragon Ball Z, no.
You haven't seen Sam Winchester?
No.
The movie?
No, I'm more of a Dean. No, I don't know. I've never seen Supernatural.
No, of course you're more of... Everybody's more of a Dean. I don't understand how this is a discussion.
Oh, Dean.
Sorry, Mrs. Padalecki. Everybody's more of a Dean.
No,
I don't know about that. I'm a Papa Winchester guy.
Oh, well, Papa Winchester, you know, you can see where they got the genes. That's all I'm saying.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, also me.
All right, now we've settled that. Well, did you guys actually post yours? Because
I
didn't.
Thank you for looking.
Not faffing
around. I didn't do yours, did you?
Mine changes on a daily basis. But the Princess Bride would be in there, and His Girl Friday, and what else? Cyrano de Bergerac, definitely. Probably Some Like It Hot, maybe Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and two others.
That's seven.
I'm really tempted to put in Hunting for the Wilder People, but that's probably only because I saw it again this week.
Did you? Okay. Interesting.
I was trying to find mine quickly. Mine are Fight Club. The Fall.
Cool.
Terminator 2.
Sorry. Cool. I'm going to need you to go back.
Oh. Do you not like Fight Club?
Fight Club. That's a controversial choice. The Fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tarsem Singh film.
Gorgeous film. I have the Blu-ray. It's really good.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. But yeah, it's one of those films that was kind of... I was told I needed to watch it, and now I feel like it's my job to... You know, my mother didn't like it, and we don't speak anymore, so...
Wow. Tearing families apart since 2000 and whatever it was.
Curse you, Lee Pace.
How dare you?
That guy.
How about you, Chris?
Nope.
Evil Dead 2.
Not doing it.
Evil Dead 2.
Well, obviously Evil Dead 2. But right. No, not doing it.
Not doing it.
No.
It's impossible.
Not at all.
Wow.
No thanks.
You monster.
Yep. Right.
Okay.
Moving on. But if you didn't take part, the hashtag is still open. I believe that's how these things work. So you can continue to do that and maybe tag us in as well so we can see.
Are we going to close the hashtag at some point?
I think the hashtag closes on Wednesday, August the 31st. Which is a real date. That's a real date. That's genuinely, that is a real date.
You thought about it and you're like...
It may not be a real date this year. No, it is, because the bank holiday Monday's on the 29th, so it's the 31st. Okay, yeah. All right, so there we go. That is the introductions out of the way. It only took 10 minutes now. So time for this week's question. Pay attention, 007, because it's not related to Bond in any way, shape, or form. This comes from Facebook.
Ooh.
I said I wanted a Facebook question this week, so I trawled through Facebook, and I found Carl Jackson had sent us a number of questions. And this is the best one. And I think this is related to the fact that the Olympics is still going on. And then we had another good one, which came in this morning, but it was too late to substitute. Not that I would substitute, Carl. Your question means a lot to me. Which was about, with the Olympics going on, what's your favourite film in which people pursue gold? Now, that's a good question.
Oh, that is.
That might be next week's question. So, get thinking. Anyway, Carl Jackson asks, which ex-sports star has had the best film career?
Ooh, I'm tempted to say Terry Crews, but then I'm always tempted to say Terry Crews. The Rock, I think. I mean, he was a college football player, and then obviously, I believe he did a little bit of wrestling.
Had he dabbled with that?
Yeah, did a little bit of a little bit here, a little bit there.
Also, he was he was a chef. Well.
He was a chef.
Yes,
he cooked.
Yeah,
he could smell it.
He was cooking. I think
banana chocolate chip pancakes were his dish of choice at one point. Anyway,
yeah.
So The Rock is probably, I mean, in terms of who had the most successful career, it's probably The Rock. But in terms of, you know, who do we love, it's also Terry Crews.
Well, see, now this is all very interesting, isn't it? Because it depends on your definition of sport.
Oh, right. Are you not counting wrestling?
No, I am counting wrestling.
You are counting wrestling.
But do you count competitive weightlifting? Because if so, the one Mr. Arnold Aloysius Schwarzenegger,
Aloysius,
might just win the day here.
He could do. I suppose he's done quite well in weightlifting as well as in movies. Yes, fair enough.
All right, I'm going to throw Schwartzy, as he likes me to call him.
You two are so close.
We're so
cute together. So cute together.
So, oh, so just got another text from him.
That's
private. yeah.
Okay.
Schwartzy.
I mean, basically the entire cast of Predator, right?
Yeah.
With the possible exception of Shane Black. I'm not sure if he was much of a sportsman before.
No, I think at that time all he could manage was a couple of push-ups.
Yeah. In contrast to everyone else in that cast.
Having said that, in that movie, he has the bulging biceps. Just when they're placed next to everyone else, you know, they do slightly pale into insignificance.
Well, I mean, everybody else is just like overly amped, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Are they? I hadn't noticed.
Well, it'd be hard for you to judge, Chris, obviously, because, you know, of your own bulging biceps.
Well, yeah, being at the pinnacle of human perfection, as I am.
As you are, yeah. Chris is actually used as the model by a lot of Batman artists.
Yeah. You know that scene in Predator where Carl Weathers and Schwarzenegger meet?
Clasp hands.
And they clasp hands, and that was based on just my handshake technique with anybody. Yeah.
Wow.
That's just what I do. That's just... I can't stop myself.
We're learning so much
today. I can't stop myself popping and sweating. That's what I do.
Well, I'd like to throw out another fine specimen. According to some, I'm, you know, whatever. Jason Statham.
Oh, yeah.
Champion.
True.
Champion, I don't know. World-class diver.
That is correct.
Yes. I've heard that he's had an all right film career.
Mm.
And, you know, of late... He's actually quite bloody funny.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
He's had a great time. Although not everyone loves his stuff, he's worked consistently.
Who doesn't love the Statham stuff?
And what kind of monster?
Name and shame.
Yeah.
No. Name and shame. Name and shame. I'm going to throw another one in.
Okay.
Johnny Weissmuller.
Johnny Weissmuller, yes.
Johnny Weissmuller says here, won 5 Olympic gold medals for swimming. So in many ways, he was the what's the bloke's name? The
Michael
one with
Phelps?
The ears. That's him.
Oh,
Michael
the
Phelps.
Ears. Yes. Say with the medals.
That's it. Yeah. On which to hang the medals. The Michael Phelps. He was in many ways the Michael Phelps of his day. So maybe Michael Phelps will go on to play Tarzan in a series of movies in which he sucks in his stomach as the years go by.
And in a similar style, Esther Williams. I mean, mm-hmm. she basically created a whole genre. She was essentially played by Scarlett Johansson recently.
Yes.
To all intents and purposes, in Hail Caesar. And apart from obviously all of the personal life stuff, we make no accusations against Esther Williams.
No. Of course not.
Of course not. But in terms of the swimming stuff, and she
that was a genuine
she was
cough,
a
by the way, not a sort of
sure.
No, seriously, it was.
Yeah, she had been headed to the 1940 Summer Olympics before, you know, World War II kind of got in the way there.
Oh,
I know, yeah. Right? But she was a competitive swimmer, so yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've also got a few people that are popping up along comedies at the moment. Not saying they've got great careers, but it's interesting to see sort of LeBron James and John Cena is everywhere right now.
He's very funny.
The time,
who
and
knew?
He is very funny.
Yeah. And LeBron was great in Trainwreck.
Also in Trainwreck. Yeah. The two of them are very, very good. And then, you know, you've got a couple of women who are trying to make a mark, like Ronda Rousey and Gina Carano.
Yeah.
Giving it a shot, you know?
Yeah. And really, you don't want to be in the way of one of their shots because
they don't waste
they
their
do not,
shots.
Yeah, they do not throw away their shots.
Yep, all that.
Yep, those are all good. Are any of them Stanley Victor Collymore?
No, they're not. Oh. No, they're not. That's why we like them.
Stan Collymore, former professional footballer.
I'm aware of this.
Big shout.
Has made one film that I know of. And that film is Basic Instinct 2, in which he appears in the opening minutes of the movie, being driven through the streets of London by Sharon Stone whilst receiving, how can I put this, manual stimulation. And at the moment of ultimate release, they crash into the Thames and poor old Stan dies, and Sharon Stone goes on to, well,
the
be in the rest of the movie, which is punishment enough. Now, I would say that little grouping of minutes, starting explosively and then ending in dismal, dripping failure, is very analogous for his Liverpool career. But there you go, Stanley Victor Collymore. I mean, that's a career in 2 minutes.
It's funny this all came up because on Twitter this morning there was a discussion going on about Ryan Lochte, the American swimmer who claimed to have been the victim of a mugging, and there are now questions emerging about that claim and about that incident and what happened and what didn't happen. And someone suggested that, you know, a slightly stupid international swimmer would be an amazing cover for an international jewel thief. And that's honestly all I can think about since this question began is the Ryan Lochte international jewel thief movie.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he could play himself, but I think Channing Tatum would make an amazing job of it. And you know, they would hide their stolen gold under their gold medals.
I've long thought that you could make a heist movie around the Olympics because they've got all the attributes, haven't they?
You could have
the pole vaulting guy. He could pole vault over the laser grid to get to the thing. Then you have the sprinter who has to run down the laser grid maze. It's all laser grids. down the laser grid maze in less than 10 seconds. Otherwise, they get chopped into pieces. Then you have the swimmer guy who swims underneath the underwater laser grid. You know.
This, honestly, it could be great. I think the problem will be getting it past the International Olympic Committee and their lawyers.
Screw those guys. We're going to call ours the Olympics.
The Olympics?
Yeah.
But honestly, it's, that's the one I want to see. That is the sports movie that I am holding out for right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is copyright The Empire Podcast. So if suddenly a heist movie set around the Olympics comes out in like 2 years' time, we're going to sue your ass.
And lose.
And I've got a gold medal in suing asses. So there you go. I'm going to throw more sports people into the mix very, very quickly. Stanley Victor Collymore is not the only football player to have dabbled on the big screen. Of course, we have Eric Cantona. Finney Jones' movie career, I would say, stands up against anyone we've mentioned on this podcast so far.
Yep.
Hey, wasn't David Beckham a projectionist quite recently?
Yes, he was.
On the big screen.
Yes, he was. And he spoke a line of dialogue in Russian.
Whoa.
Which, given that English often seems beyond him, is quite an achievement.
Hey, come on.
National treasure.
National treasure.
Come on. Ease off
Book
the
of
Bex.
Book of Secrets.
Ali McCoist.
Ali
Who?
McCoist.
Ali McCoist of Rangers in Scotland fame, team host on A Question of Sport, was in Robert Duvall's A Shot at Glory, playing a character not entirely a million miles removed from Ali McCoist.
Gosh.
But he was actually very good.
You'd hope.
He was very good. Who else? Jim Brown from the Dirty Dozen, former American football player, Fred Williamson, also also Bubba Smith,
mm-hmm. of course,
Hightower from the Police Academy movies, former American football player. But there you go.
We haven't mentioned the Escape to Victory lots because they've come up before.
Yeah.
We haven't mentioned Lance Armstrong because we don't anymore, even though we still love that cameo. But no, he's ruined it. Anyway, with some other things, but I think the cameo was the worst thing.
Was Chuck Norris not a sports star before?
I believe he was, yes.
Martial arts, yeah.
I believe he was.
Yeah.
I mean, but actually, I mean, if we're looking at martial arts, I mean, all those guys, Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme have incredible martial arts skills, actually.
If you
look back at their competitive years, they were winning a whole lot of very impressive titles.
Yeah, you can't just improvise that stuff.
No.
You have to learn it somewhere along the line. Yeah.
So,
those guys.
So I'm not sure we've had a definitive single answer to the question, but we've definitely had a discussion around it.
The answer is Schwarzenegger. The question is, which has had the best film career?
Oh, well,
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it could be Schwarzenegger. But I mean, he probably was the highest paid guy in town for a while, wasn't he? Because The Rock, I believe, is now the highest paid guy in town. So,
in town.
Mm-hmm. Which town is this? Scunthorpe.
London town.
The Rock is the highest. Really?
Apparently. Yeah, that's something I read recently. He was the highest paid actor in Hollywood last year.
And he totally posted that all over
Instagram. Is that because he made 75 movies?
I mean, it's kind of cheating because he worked harder than everybody else. So, you know, he doesn't need to make as much per movie. But at the same time, that is also part of being successful.
He produces a lot of stuff too, doesn't he?
Yeah. Same thing. That's why I do a lot of podcasts.
Uh-huh.
I get paid per podcast. Don't you guys get paid per podcast? I get paid per podcast.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, what is this company?
A penny per podcast. A shiny golden penny. Right, should we have some movie news?
Yeah, let's do it.
What's been happening in the world of the movies?
Can I do the Hamilton news roundup to begin with?
Oh, God forbid we don't mention Hamilton on our podcast. Yeah, let's start with that.
Yeah, let's start with Hamilton. Well, there's actually kind of two exciting bits of Hamilton news this week. Let's start with the slightly less obvious one, which is that Leslie Odom Jr., who played Aaron Burr in the show, he's kind of the narrator, antagonist, anti-hero type person in the show, and he won a Tony for his efforts, deservedly so. He has left the show and he is now taking a new role. He's in talks to join Kenneth Branagh's new version of Murder on the Orient Express. So Branagh went aboard the film in June of last year. He's planning to direct and star as Poirot in the movie, and it's Poirot trying to solve a mystery on a train. I could tell you who done it, but that would spoil the film.
Don't do that.
Some of you may not remember the book and or the previous films. So this of course follows on the Sidney Lumet film of 1974, which had everyone in Hollywood in it, and this one's due out next year, but they're still not telling us much about it. This would only make Odom Jr. the second confirmed cast member. We don't know which role he'd be playing, and we don't know who else will be in it, so this is just the start.
It doesn't get much better than that.
Hey, I did say that's why I'm rounding it up, you know. That's why I'm taking one story and then putting it together with another story to make it sound more exciting than it is.
But he's definitely not playing the Orient Express.
He's definitely not playing the train.
Sure of.
Yes.
I'm not ruling anything out at this point. If you're in Hamilton, then you can surely do anything.
I mean, he's won a Tony, right?
You can. And he's won a Tony, all right?
I'm going to New York this week.
Uh-huh.
Oh, good luck.
I'm not going to see Hamilton.
You never know. You might find a cheap ticket.
It's
probably not going to happen. Also in Hamilton news, the composer, writer, star Lin-Manuel Miranda, ex-star now he's left, is continuing his association with the Mouse House. Now, he's obviously already written some music for Moana, which is their upcoming animation. He is moving from that into Mary Poppins, where he'll be taking an acting role rather than a sort of compositional role. And he is now teaming up with Alan Menken to do the music on the Little Mermaid. And I'm super excited about this. Alan Menken is a guy who started off also writing musicals. He wrote Little Shop of Horrors with his writing partner Howard Ashman, and the two of them were recruited by John Musker and Ron Clements to go to Disney and write the music for the original Little Mermaid. Ashman sadly died of AIDS while they were working on Beauty and the Beast together, but Menken went on to work with Disney throughout the 90s. He won so many Oscars that they actually changed the category definitions so other people would have a chance. I'm not kidding. I think he won 8 in the 90s. It was insane. And so it's really exciting that he's back doing the music for this new Little Mermaid Mermaid, and it's very, very exciting that Lin-Manuel is kind of joining him, because I think that the kind of trajectory of his career does have comparisons to Menken, and especially to what he and Ashman did with Little Shop of Horrors, which was to create a really witty spin on the musical in a different way than we'd seen before. And I think that's what Manuel did with Hamilton as well. So to see them working together, I think is really, really exciting, and it gets me much more fired up than I already was for a live action Little Mermaid.
And he's like a super big fan, because his son's called super Sebastian fan. As well.
Oh. But he is a fan, because like if you listen to Hamilton on repeat obsessively,
not that we would. Chris does that all the time.
Yeah, Chris, but not us.
What was happening?
Anyway, if you listen to it on repeat, you will notice a quote from Macbeth in Hamilton, and that quote is, of course, thanks, screw your courage to the sticking place, which is also the line that Menken and Ashman nicked for one of the songs in Beauty and the Beast. And I am pretty sure, actually, with all due respect to Lin-Manuel Miranda, that he probably thought of that line first from Beauty and the Beast and second from Macbeth. So I think he's a big, big fan of Menken's work.
Dissing Lin-Manuel Miranda?
No, not at all. I'm saying he has pop culture roots as much as he has Shakespeare scholarship.
Mm-hmm. I'm telling him.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Oh, I just got text from...
It's okay joking about Schwarzenegger texting you, but it's not okay to suggest that you're Lin-Manuel Miranda's friend. His friend.
I'm sorry, Helen, but my text says otherwise.
Oh, really? You want to show me that?
As I said, my texts are private from Linny.
Linny?
Linny.
I feel that's not right. Anyway, Alan Menken, that was the news.
Alan Menken. That was it. Alan Menken, I'm surprised, honestly, that he hasn't been used more recently. Because, as we know, he wrote the music for Sausage Party.
He did, yes.
Which we saw this week.
Which, actually, I was watching that and thinking, this is very Menken-esque. Mm. And it turns out there was a reason for that.
There's a big musical number in the middle of beginning of Sausage Party, which you have to see to believe.
You really do.
We'll talk about it in a few weeks. But also, a song that's very close to our hearts.
Yes.
Star-Spangled Man from Captain America, the First Avenger. And there's the Marvel mention.
Yes.
There we go.
That's it, guys.
Hamilton and Marvel. If you're playing the drinking game at home, then you're pissed now. You're probably catatonic.
And probably pissed that we keep mentioning Hamilton and Marvel.
Yeah, but don't worry. When Marvel make the Hamilton movie...
Well, can you imagine?
God.
Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda officially becomes part of the MCU, and Helen explodes. And then here's the ultimate film, right?
Okay. The ultimate Helen film.
Kevin Feige.
Right.
Comic-Con next year.
Yeah.
Announces that Lin-Manuel Miranda has superpowers and is actually part of the MCU, and they're making the Lin-Manuel Miranda, that's really tough to say, origin tale. And in that movie, he would be played by Jensen Ackles.
Oh, my goodness.
At that point, I think Helen would cease to exist. There would be just a singularity.
A shower of glitter I once stood.
Yeah, I think that's what would happen. So, Star Spangled Man is such a great moment.
Star Spangled Man is wonderful.
Wonderful song. So, yay for Alan Menken.
I ran a marathon at the weekend. And then came home and...
just drop that in there.
Went home and collapsed and wasn't really fit to do anything, and watched Captain America the First Avenger on TV, and that was my cool down. Wind down from the marathon. It was great.
So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happened in the last week. Some of it good and some of it very, very sad, as we'll get to in a second. But some interesting news is that the long dormant Holmes and Watson comedy, which was to star Will Ferrell and Sacha Baron Cohen back in the day, has been revived and given a lick of paint and will now star Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly.
Ooh. Awesome. I'm quite excited by that. I think they're a great combo. They work so well together. And I can see them looking like Holmes and Watson. You know, Ferrell is tall enough that he can kind of make Holmes work, even though he's maybe not the most traditional Holmes we've ever seen.
Because I believe it was the other way around when Sacha Baron Cohen was announced that he was going to be Holmes Ferrell was going to be Watson. And we don't know what the story is. I mean, obviously there's been a couple of comedies about Sherlock Holmes in the past. I think probably the most recent one was Without a Clue. Mm-hmm. The conceit of which is that Holmes was an idiot, an actor hired by the real genius, Watson. So Michael Caine was Holmes, and Sir Ben Kingsley was Watson. And I really like that film. I've got a lot of time for it, although I haven't seen it for a long, long time. But it feels that this is ripe comedic territory.
Yeah, everybody knows the setup, so you can now make fun of it.
Yeah.
A little bit.
But... I don't know. Maybe there's enough comic relief already in the iterations of Holmes that we have at the moment, the Robert Downey Jr. Holmes and the Benedict Cumberbatch Holmes.
Maybe, but I think it'll work quite well with the two of them kind of alternating straight and not so straight man roles. I think it could work quite well. And Ferrell is so good at being pompous.
Yes.
That I think he could make a wonderful, wonderful Sherlock Holmes.
I think it'd be super fun. Mm.
Yeah, this is being directed by Ethan Coen, I think, which is maybe not quite such a reliable pair of hands as, say, Adam McKay would be.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to hope for the best with the cast.
Yeah, absolutely. His last movie as director was Get Hard. That's not a good calling card.
No.
But,
you know.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
He wrote the script and hopefully it'll be funny.
Also news this week that A Star Is Born is finally happening, the one that Bradley Cooper's been, you know, looking to direct for a while. He's going to star in it, still making his directorial debut, but Lady Gaga is now definitely on board to play that eponymous role that's been played so many times before. It's a weird one, this, because it's gone through so many different people. At times there was chat of, you know, Leo doing it.
Or Beyonce and Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, Beyonce for Clint Eastwood, yeah.
Which I was, that version was the one that I thought, you know, her, DiCaprio, Eastwood, yeah. I thought that was the one.
I would have preferred a version where she directs and Clint Eastwood is the star who's discovered.
Do you know what? I think that might. Okay, no, that was the version that I was really hoping for. you know, give Clint another Oscar there. It says that, you know, after sort of meeting with Gaga and screen test, that she's won the role and she's having such an amazing time right now because she's, you know, she's winning awards for her role in American Horror Story and everyone's sort of raving about her in that. We know that she's got some serious pipes.
We also know she's got a poker face.
But she does.
I imagine that served her well on the screen test.
Yeah, this, I mean, this could be interesting. I think I was a bit more excited about the Beyonce one.
And yeah.
This is one of those rare cases where you actually want a little bit of an age gap between the central couple, and these two don't feel like they're that far apart in age. Maybe I'm being just wrong.
Isn't she still in her 20s or something?
I think she's just over 30.
Yeah, she's been around a lot longer than she has, if that makes sense. But it doesn't feel like as much of an event yet as the other one did. You know, when it was announced Eastwood was doing it, that was huge.
Yeah.
And it's obviously Bradley's first film, which...
Oh, Bradley, yeah.
Oh, Bradders.
Oh, Bradders.
Bradders,
now.
Yeah.
You got a text from him?
No.
No, you haven't.
No.
Because my phone just went.
Maybe.
Oh, look who it is.
Is it Beaky?
It's my mate, Bradders. Oh, he and Linny want to join me for drinks later on.
These are not nicknames. Stop it.
Bradders and Linny.
Bradders and Linny. It sounds like an unlikely indie movie.
Sounds like Biggles' backup crew. Come on, Bradders. Come on, Linny. Let's stick it to the Luftwaffe.
But yeah, so we have no idea what his directing potential is like. He's obviously worked for some huge people and, you know, he's worked for Clint Eastwood and everything, and maybe that will stand him in good stead. Maybe David O. Russell will be kind of, you know, the other end of the phone, giving him some pointers.
But yeah.
I don't know.
If he tells you to hurt people, Bradders, maybe don't listen.
No, maybe not.
Oh, I love the idea of, like, you know, Bradley, where are you pointing your camera? At a wall. No, you idiots! If you learn nothing from my movies, point it at the people. Oh yeah, that's right. Thanks David. I don't know what I've done without you. Bye. I think Bradders knows.
Bradders,
he knows to point the camera at the people.
But yeah, I like the idea of maybe Robert De Niro popping up now in some sort of cameo role.
Somebody's dad. It doesn't really matter who, just somebody's dad.
God's dad.
So Bradders is starring as well as
he is starring, because before you had like Tom Cruise and Will Smith also being mentioned as well. But
I looked him up, he's 11 years older than her, so I guess that's kind of a
that's a pretty
gap.
Decent age
gap. And with makeup and judicious use of camera angles, he can
angles.
He can look maybe 12 or 13 years older than
give him some facial hair, more facial hair.
He's got a lot of facial hair at the
Make
moment
him look
though.
Grizzled.
Was there a big difference between, was it Chris Christopherson and Babs in the 76 version?
I'd have to check.
I don't know if there's a huge difference between those two. I think they're roughly the same age.
I feel like he's a good bit older.
You think?
Do you not think? I'm thinking of him being extremely grizzled in the Blade movies.
Yeah.
The Empire podcast, where we Google actors' ages in real time. This is extraordinary. What's happening? How old is Chris Christopherson?
He was born in 1936.
Okay. Which makes him?
I don't know.
80.
And she was born in, although we shouldn't ask her age. She was born in 42.
All right. So
she is 6 years younger.
1974.
Yeah.
All right.
Hmm.
Just saying. Mic drop.
But interestingly, Gaga is also writing new music for this.
Yeah. Cool.
Which, I mean, get Linny on board, and I think we've got a winner. I don't know. We'll see. First to get to an eagle out of two of them. Bets now.
I'd have Bradley Cooper.
I mean, no.
Lin-Manuel.
Or Bradley. No, Lin and Gaga.
Oh, Lin and Gaga.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, hang on.
Okay.
Bradders is a potential EGOT as well, isn't he? I mean, he's been nominated for Oscars.
Sure.
He hasn't won one yet.
No.
Unless I've missed something.
No, he hasn't.
But was he nominated? He probably was nominated for a Tony for his Elephant Man.
Could have been. He was very good in that.
I'm
not sure if he won.
No.
So
not only are we googling people's ages.
Is there a nomination EGOT then?
Yeah, he's a nomination EGOT. All he needs is a Grammy. So and
everybody just needs to do a spoken word album at some point so they can all win a Grammy. Yeah.
And he's bound to be nominated at some point for Alias, right? So that's presumed.
I mean,
for Alias.
He's just one nomination for a Grammy. Yes, for Alias. He was amazing in Alias.
And then
he's just one potential nomination away from being an EGOT nominee.
Well, I can tell you he's been nominated for an Empire Award.
Well, that's an E.
Yeah, and for a Golden Globe.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a G.
We know about the Oscar.
That's a G.
That's an O.
It's not quite the same, Chris.
Give us a T. Give us a T.
Teen Choice Award.
Teen Choice Awards!
Oh, yes.
And a Tony.
And a Tony.
And a Tony. There we go. So he's an EGOT!
Nominee.
Lots of, yeah.
I'll take it all back. You beat Lin and Lady.
He's going to be so pumped when I text him. Bradders. LOL.
What else?
What's the hashtag? I've said about an aubergine. What does that mean?
Hashtag EGOT.
Yeah, I've accidentally sent him an emoji. I meant to send him an award, but I sent him the aubergine followed by the splash one.
No. Helen, what else?
Oh,
what does that mean?
I just think that means wash your vegetables before eating them.
Okay. That's what it means. Well, you know, he's got to get in good shape, right? So it's important to have those.
It's a friendly reminder.
Hey, let's move really fast on to another story.
It's good advice, Helen.
Yeah. John Krasinski, who is a lovely, lovely man and extremely handsome with his beard.
He could play Michael Phelps.
Oh, my goodness.
He could play Michael Phelps.
He absolutely 100% could, yeah.
He has the body. He has the ears. Let's be honest. He's got lovely ears.
He's tall, but he's not Phelps tall, but he's tall.
But Phelps is like a weird
giant
mutant person who has no, like in a good way. Obviously, like he's won like a million gold medals by
a
being
good mutant.
Yeah, but he genuinely
like
has like a longer body than he should, and a shorter legs than he should, and longer arms than he should. Mm. As you know, compared to most people in the population, and that's what makes him a great swimmer.
Yeah,
or part of it, obviously, dedication and training and all that.
And eating 20 meals a day.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, John Krasinski, getting back to the subject,
is
going to star in a new Jack Ryan series for Amazon. It's had the green light this week. It's going to be called, I think, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, and it means that he'll be playing the Marine turned CIA analyst turned, he had a spell in the middle there as a stockbroker, which I've probably slightly left out. Anyway, CIA analyst turned CIA deputy director who becomes vice president, who becomes president. The books are actually kind of cool. Like, there's a lot going on for Jack Ryan across the course of the books, and we've only seen actually a fraction of it on screen, despite the fact that he's been played by like five different good people. There was Alec Baldwin, Harrison Ford, Ben Affleck, and Chris Pine. Okay, so five now with Krasinski. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot more that they could tell. They haven't really done Cardinal of the Kremlin, for example, which I think I remember being one of his.
Great name.
It's a good title, isn't it? And obviously all the stuff where he becomes vice president and president hasn't been touched on. There's a whole lot of other Jack Ryan books, Jack Ryan stories that they can tell. So this is kind of cool. I think the Jack Ryan movie, the Kenneth Branagh one, didn't really set the world alight in the way that they were maybe hoping.
It certainly did not.
Mm. But, he could kind of work on in a kind of longer form TV show. So I think this is kind of exciting.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement. And John Krasinski is a good choice.
Yes, he is.
He has action hero chops. But also, as we know from The Office, he's frighteningly good at sitting behind a desk doing admin. Which is a lot of what Jack Ryan does. He's a bit of a pencil pusher. He's not always the guy who he is.
How dare you, sir? How dare you?
He likes to file reports.
You like to file reports.
The most exciting moment in any of the Jack Ryan movies is the bit in Clear Present Danger where he and Henry Cerny are battling
for the printer.
Yeah, they're battling for a printer. That's essentially what's happening in that movie. And that's what Jack Ryan is. He's not the guy that you drop into the firefight and he takes out 20 guys. That's the other Jack. That's Reacher. This guy, he's more cerebral. He fights in the mind.
He does, but he also, you know, can,
what that means.
He can also kill people when called upon to do so.
He can, that's the interesting with a stapler.
Because there's that great bit in the book where he becomes president, the name of which I've forgotten. Executive orders? I don't know, something like that.
Executive thingy.
But there's the whole discussion where his kind of political enemies are going, this guy's killed people with his bare hands. Can we have a president who has killed people with his bare hands? Is that okay? And you know, that's kind of a cool little angle on a person, I think. And I don't know. You're right, he is very, very, very intellectual. He does solve puzzles rather than just going around shooting people like Bond does.
Well, like Sudoku and stuff.
Yeah, probably.
Cool.
Crosswords, that kind of... He can probably do, like, the difficult times crossword, not just, like, the easy one that we sometimes do over lunch.
Man.
I know.
That's
so,
a dream right there.
So, I don't know. I'm kind of excited for it, and I think it could be really good. And obviously, Krasinski is not exactly difficult on the eyes, so...
But is he better than the Winchesters? That is the question.
I think I'd really have to sit down and, you know, really think about that at length.
Controversial.
With pictures.
Now, I'm very excited this week because Guillermo del Toro's new film, The Shape of Water, has started filming in Toronto, which I believe is in Canada. Don't know a whole lot about the movie at the moment. There's a one-line description of it, which is an otherworldly story set against the backdrop of Cold War America circa 1963.
Oh, so there's a sort of Cold War link to Ryan there. Carry on.
Yeah. See, we don't just throw this stuff together on the Empire, I want to say, podcast. So, great cast: Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins, Michael Stuhlbarg, Octavia Spencer, and of course, because it's Guillermo del Toro, Doug Jones.
Yeah.
And now, will it be Doug Jones, or will it be Doug Jones under layers of prosthetics? Who knows? But that's happening right now in Canada. And Guillermo definitely seems to be backing away from the big behemoth blockbusters. So he's not necessarily doing one for... Well, not that he ever really did one for Lem, one for me, because all his blockbusters are personal.
Yeah.
But The Hobbit was certainly one for Lem, had it happened. But he certainly seems to be moving away from the big movie, small movie, and now just doing small. Whereas Stephen E. DeKnight now, as we know, is directing Pacific Rim 2, mm-hmm. and not Guillermo. So this is very interesting, I would say.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Any Guillermo film is something to look out for, I think, and get excited about. I'm very jealous that we're not in LA right now to go and see the exhibition of all his stuff at LACMA, which looks
amazing.
Incredible. So, yeah, big up to him.
Okay, now some very, very sad news to round off the news section. First of all, this is a sad one for us here in the UK. So the Metrodome Group, Metrodome Distribution, one of the smaller distribution companies in the UK over the last few years, they've been responsible for the likes of distributing art house movies and movies that need a wider audience, movies like Monster and Donnie Darko and The Secret in Their Eyes and The Counterfeiters and movies like that. In fact, a movie that's going to come out this weekend, we're going to talk about it, called The Childhood of a Leader. They have gone into administration. And most staff, and this is according to Screen Daily, most staff have been made redundant. No official statement has yet been made, but apparently it has come as something of a shock. And on the same day, another independent stalwart, Fortissimo, also filed for voluntary bankruptcy. Now, this is a very sad development, and I think perhaps one that speaks to the somewhat powerless nature of movies at the moment, certainly smaller movies. We talk constantly on the podcast about how smaller movies and mid-sized movies are finding it harder to A, get made, and B, get distribution, and see fight for space in a marketplace up against the giant movies, the franchise films. And that certainly seems to be the way of it with this. Fortissimo, for example, most recently distributed Thebe and Ira Sachs Love is Strange, that very good John Lithgow Alfred Molina movie, which came out last year. Sad times.
It is, it's it gives you an idea just how tough it is out there for people with the smaller kind of films, you know, coming out and trying to make an impact in a market that is saturated with all the coverage. And, you know, we talk a lot about them as well, but the big films tend to suck up a lot of the oxygen, I think, in terms of screens, in terms of, you know, advertising, in terms of just space in theatres and space in people's heads. And it is difficult. And, you know, they're being squeezed from the other direction as well by, you know, really good streaming distributors and so on, giving people films at home so you don't even need to leave the house to see great indie movies. So I think it's a really tough time, and they've both done amazing work promoting great, great films that deserved a great audience. And and I think it's really sad to see them go.
Indeed. Well, you know, hopefully we've seen companies go into administration and come out the other side.
Fingers crossed.
So fingers crossed indeed for both Metrodome and Fortissimo Films. And to all our friends at both companies, our thoughts are with you guys. And also on another very, very sad note, in the last week or so, a couple of icons of the film industry left us. First, of course, was Kenny Baker, who passed away last week. R2-D2 himself.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to meet him once. We were on Richard and Judy together, and he was a very, very lovely man. He was a real charmer, a really funny, smart, kind individual. And obviously, he's also R2-D2, who was an absolute icon of, I think, everyone's childhood. I don't know of any child ever who has watched those films and not instantly fallen in love with him and not instantly wanted him as a best friend, because you understood exactly what he was saying, you know, without... I mean, part of that was obviously Ben Burtt's signs, but part of it was also Kenny Baker in there giving him his heart and giving him his soul, and doing so often in the desert heat, you know, sweating and in discomfort the entire time, and still sort of emerging smiling at every break and, you know, at every opportunity. So he obviously did more than that. Time Bandits, another great Kenny Baker performance, but I think that's the one that he's going to go down in history for, and deservedly so.
Indeed. And to echo so many tweets, sad beep.
Sad beep.
Sad beep. And also, Arthur Hiller passed away last night. We record this podcast on Thursday. As he passed away on Wednesday night, Arthur Hiller, the great director of so many great comedies, The Out-of-Towners and Silver Streak and The In-Laws. Weirdly enough, I spoke to Alan Arkin. I had the good pleasure of speaking to Alan Arkin recently about that movie and about Alan Arkin's career. And he says The In-Laws is one of the favourite movies of his career. He absolutely enjoyed, loved working on it, and loved working with Arthur Hiller, and what a legend, what a genius he was. And a couple of things, obviously, you know, Silver Streak, as I mentioned, See No Evil, Hear No Evil. So
Dustin Hoffman's cinema debut apparently was in The Tiger Makes Out, which was one of his.
Well, there you go.
And of course, Love Story is the one he got an Oscar nomination for. I mean, it's melodrama with a capital mellow, but but he made it a gigantic success, a gigantic hit, and you know, it does kind of have its place on a Sunday afternoon when you just want to sit and watch something, I don't know, gentle. But I think actually that does reflect Hiller himself a little bit. He apparently proposed to his wife for the first time when he was aged 8, and they didn't get married immediately. They waited a little bit longer, but they were married for 68 years.
Wow.
And she died last June, but he's survived by his daughter, son, and 5 grandchildren.
Wow. 68
years, man.
Wow.
That's incredible.
He also directed the first episode of The Addams Family back in the 60s.
Oh, thank you for that.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, there we go. Arthur Hiller, who passed away this week, and Kenny Baker, who passed away last week. Okay, time now for this week's guest. He is one of the true mavericks of world cinema, who constantly surprises audiences with his audacity and verve. But enough about Phil Desemlian. They also say the same about the great Spanish director Pedro Almodovar, the man behind Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Tie Me Down, High Heels, All About My Mother, Talk to Her, Bad Education,
Volver,
thank you, The Skin I Live In. The legend. The man's a legend. He has a new film, Julieta. My God. Such a difficult language, this English. What is going on? Julieta, out soon. And when he came to London last week, obviously there was only one man who could talk to him, our art house guru, Phil Desemlian. Do enjoy.
We are incredibly, really delighted, thrilled to have the great Pedro Almodovar on the Empire podcast this week.
Thank you.
Welcome to you. And his interpreter Maria is here as well, just to help us out if my questions are too tangled and complex. And last night, of course, you had the premiere of your new movie, Julieta.
Yes.
Julieta,
as you want. I mean, in Spanish, we have this sound, La Jota, Julieta, but it's, I mean, you can say Juliet or Julieta, whatever you want.
I'm going to go English and just say Julieta.
Yes. Originally, it was Juliet.
Juliet. And you had that at Somerset House in London.
Yes.
And there's a great picture, a great photo of you on on the internet now doing, I guess you could call it a Bono. It's a bit of a, you know, Bono from U2. You've got your arms out and you're doing a selfie with the crowd.
You know, I was really, I mean, it's a wonderful feeling just to be in front of 2,000 souls sitting down on floor, incredibly relaxed, and just trying to celebrate the screening, because this is what the idea of cinema was for me when I was a child. You know, in at open air, just to see a movie in that kind of atmosphere. So it was great.
So the tragedy is that Giulietta is her daughter has left effectively, and the film is cut across two timelines, the sort of the modern day, and it folds back to the 80s. You cast two different people to play the role of Giulietta because you don't like the prosthetics of aging, but they didn't really meet. Adriano Ugarte and Emma Suarez, you kept them apart for the shoot. Did you know that they knew each other before you started filming?
I don't know if they are very different as persons and also as actresses. I mean, you mean the two actresses?
Yes, yeah.
And at the beginning, I was concerned about that they should imitate one of them. So I decided that Adriana should imitate Emma. But I decided only two things. The way she walked, because it's a movie where the character walks a lot in the streets, and Emma has a very particular way of walking, and I remember myself walking with the two of them, just trying to make the same kind of walk than Emma, and also the way she smoked cigarettes. But there were no room for sequences where Adriana could smoke, so it was helpless. But at the end, you know, summarizing this, I thought that it was not necessary to look like exactly the same. It is the same character, but in two very different ages and with different experiences. So the mature Giulietta is someone very sad. I mean, a face that contained a lot of pain experiences in the last 13 years. And the young Giulietta is full of joy, full of excitement, represents a woman of Madrid in the 80s. So, you know, the 80s, that decade, it is very important for us because it was like the rebirth of the democracy in Spain after living under an awful dictatorship of 40 years. So Giulietta, the young Giulietta, represents, is a woman of the 80s, very free in every aspect, and very young and enjoying and celebrating everything. So very different from the other. That was also the reason, because and also, you know, I wanted to have the freedom of taking this kind of elections, two actresses. I mean, Buñuel did it more outrageously and more interesting than I in Oscuro Objeto de Deseo, that obscure object of desire. I don't know if you remember, he decided that the character, the protagonist, should be made by two very different actresses, Ángela Molina and Carol Bouquet, just representing the different moments of the character, when one is passionate and the other one is very cold. So, I mean, if Buñuel did it long time ago, I thought that I could do it in this movie.
I wonder if, you know, when you were starting out and the Movida movement was taking shape, do you feel a sense of jealousy about filmmakers now that are in that position, who are just starting their careers, who have the opportunity to use mobile phone cameras to make movies? The means of making films seems to have got that much easier. Or do you feel a sense of sympathy that it's harder to get films made now?
I think for the young authors is harder everywhere. Thinking if I were a boy now of 20 years old, I'm sure that I will make a movie with a mobile. There is a lot of machine that helps you to tell one story. And what I wanted and what I dream of when I was very young, it was just to tell one story with images. So, the closer system for me, it was the Super 8 millimeter camera. So I did. But now, I mean, it is easier. And you almost, with nothing, you can make, I mean, you can tell one story. Because that was my ambition, yes, to tell stories. And this is something that now you can do it easier than in the 70s. But you cannot be your life filming with a mobile. I mean, this should be the very first step, but the second should be something different. Should be, a regular screen movie.
Yes.
That I don't know if everyone has the possibility of doing that.
Are you a big cinema goer yourself? Do you go to the cinema a lot to see other movies?
A
Do you
lot,
see
yes.
American movies?
Well, I see everything. I'm a good movie goer. Well, I have to say that I don't find many movies that after I'm getting out the theater, like, you know, Enchanted or Lighter or Satisfied. But I mean, I go every weekend, like at least two times to the cinema. And it is becoming very difficult to find good movies, at least for me. I see everything, but I think it's more difficult now for the directors, just to make independent movies where they can behave completely free, without thinking about the market.
Mm. You're a member of the Academy. What was your choice for best film this year?
Yo soy miembro de la Academia.
Yes.
And what was
your best film, best picture? Which did you vote for?
Last year, I voted for one that it was not in the.
No, really.
For Carol.
Oh, okay. The Patricia Highsmith adaptation.
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
By Todd Haynes.
Which I imagine.
I love that movie.
Yes, I imagine that.
And I thought it was very unfair, the results, not only in box office, but also, for me, it was one of the best movies of last year.
A beautiful film. And I think.
Well, really, I have to say that the best movie that I remember, it was not among the eight nominees. It was El Club. The Club.
Oh, Pablo Larraín.
Pablo Larraín, yeah. Absolutely, it was the best movie for me, but I couldn't vote it.
this is a film about abusive priests in South America, is it not?
So yes,
yeah.
I think I'm a subject that I felt also very close. I made my own movie about that in Bad Education. But really, I mean, I think it's a great script. And a great movie, what Pablo Larraín. I'm dying to see the new one, Neruda. And well, it's very productive. It's one of, I mean, the last movie, Jackie will be in the Venice Film Festival.
Look out for that. Do you keep up with what some of your closer sort of acting collaborators are doing? Antonio Banderas, Penelope Cruz, when they're working on other projects, do you always kind of make sure you see their films? I guess what I'm driving at is, have you seen Antonio in SpongeBob SquarePants, Sponge Out of Water?
Si, has visto Antonio en SpongeBob SquarePants, que ese animado, esa película animada de ese carácter que es una esponja.
Bob Esponja.
Bob Esponja.
I mean, we call it in Spanish, Bob Esponja.
Say that again?
Bob Esponja.
Wow, I can't say that.
Sounds
that,
quite different.
That means Bob the Sponge.
Right, good, excellent.
No, I didn't. I didn't. How was it?
It was fine. He plays a pirate. He came on this podcast. And
I think he made very well. I mean, just to put the boys like he did before with the cut.
Yes.
I mean, this is a kind of work that he enjoyed very much.
Yes.
And he's very good with that.
Has he sent you any samples of his aftershave range, for instance? what is it called?
Yeah, well, I mean, don't make me judge. I think it's fun. There is a lot of fun doing that, and also he enjoyed really doing this. But it's, you know, I'm well, this is not my cup of tea.
No, no, you say. Fair enough.
But I have to say that if I have to say that I loved it, I love.
No, no.
Because it means money, it means, and also he's always very funny doing this kind of advertising.
Yes. Your next movie is your 21st.
Yeah.
Which here is, I don't know if it's the same in Spain, it's a very big sort of celebration. Do you have an idea yet of what that might be? Or what do you do when you finish, when you've released a movie into the world?
Well, I'm writing now, and there is two stories that, I mean, I'm sure that the next movie is between these two. So one is comedy, dark, very dark comedy, and the other is drama. It's a drama more in the line of Julieta. I don't know which one of them I finish first, but I know more or less what will be the next one.
Do you sort of let your mood take you towards one or other of the genres?
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's always the story, because I say two, because really, I mean, in this moment I'm writing these two, but I have more stories. And I'm taking notes almost every day about a lot of stories. And there is one moment when one drives you to finish. So I decided that it's more the story that choose me to finish and to make to finish the first draft.
I wanted to ask you about Brokeback Mountain, because this was a project that was potentially going to be your English language movie. Ang Lee obviously made it in the end.
Yep.
Yours was going to be different, and I just wondered what would have Pedro Amaro
more sex? More sex. And this is not gratuitous. The Annie Proulx story is about a physical relation, an animal relation. So, I mean, sex is necessary because, I mean, it's the body of the story. So I always have the image that, these two guys start making love each other, like the animals that they were taking care of. I mean, against the cold in the mountain. Yes, a way to survive in the mountain. At the end, they discovered that it was something else, and they were surprised. It was like a big accident. But, the physical part, it is about that. So, I love the movie of that Ang Lee did, and I love the actors, both of them. They were incredibly. But I always thinking about Annie Proulx and not Hollywood. I thought my point of view, it was not so easy to make. So I was thinking and thinking, because of course they promise you of kind of freedom, artistic freedom, of course. And also I like very much Larry McMurtry's work. Mm. But it seems to me that I could do that in Europe, but not in the United States.
Pedro Amaro, it's been an incredible pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the Empire Podcast.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank you a lot.
Right, that was Pedro. Time now for this week's reviews section. Let's start with the return of Ricky Gervais as David Brent from The Office in David Brent Life on the Road. Emma.
Yes, so as Chris said, Brent is back. This time he's come out of the office and he's decided that he's still working in an office, but he's decided that he needs to just, you know, take that last chance and go out on the road and try and do that one thing he's always wanted to do. He just wants to sing, man, you know. Much to everyone in the office's amusement, he heads out with a band, throwing all his money at the wall, and he heads out to all these different small little stops along the road, you know, like your local social club, kind of big pubs. He goes by way of Student Union, as you can imagine, which is quite an interesting one, in hopes of trying to secure a record deal, which, as I'm sure many of us would assume, is quite a tall order. For those of you who saw the video Equality Street that they released a little while ago, you'll see the rapper Dom Johnson, Ben Bailey Smith, so he's also in it as well, going along begrudgingly as Gervais is playing his manager as well on the side. The aspirations of the rapper and Brent don't sit too well together, as one of them's sort of, you know, stuck in his ways and the other's trying to pursue a rap career. And to be honest, that's pretty much it, really. I think most people were worried that it would taint the memory of The Office, and it doesn't do that, as it does take that whole scenario out on the road, and it doesn't really mess too much with the previous formula. But the thing is, I think it kind of does miss Merchant to an extent, insofar that I think that he maybe might have played a few beats a tad more subtly, because Brent's still very much this sort of racist, not completely out and out racist, but he's accidentally quote unquote racist, and there's a lot of talk of disabled people and all this kind of thing. But that's how Brent has always been, and he hasn't changed, even if I guess the world that watches it has. So it kind of makes sense that Gervais is still playing it that way, even if he's been getting some flack for it, to be honest.
But then wouldn't it be funnier, I think, like, that was one of the things that struck me as well, wouldn't it be funnier if he was trying more to move with the times? Because I think he does try. That's part of the joke, isn't it? He's always tried to be terribly right on, and then he nevertheless comes across as incredibly, you know, patronising, prejudiced, whatever. I feel like he should be trying harder, and I feel like that would help those jokes land more, you know?
Yeah. I was in a huge, huge packed screen, and people, you sort of had patches of people that were laughing and patches of people that were like, can they say that?
Really?
And there's some issues with the N-word and all this kind of stuff, which, I don't know, there are people that were really appreciating it and enjoying it a lot, and I don't think Gervais is in any way trying to be controversial or whatever. That's just what the character's always been like.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why you have to know The Office to sort of forgive, again, quote unquote, Brent, because there's not really any room for outsiders anyway, and maybe it wouldn't sit so well with people that have never watched it.
Well, I haven't watched a lot of The Office, and I thought this started really strong, but I've seen, like, some episodes. Don't shout at me, please.
No.
But, you know, I don't love cringe humour. I don't love the kind of stuff where you end up just covering your eyes and just sinking into your seat going, oh God, please don't say that. And this has that, but it's still funny. I recognise that The Office is very funny at doing that, and I felt like this was a little bit more hit and miss, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's slightly stuck in a time warp. That's kind of always been his issue, and everyone around him is trying to kind of push him the right way, but then they sort of give up. That's just how it's always been, really. And it's, I think the movie's maybe a tad more cringe than the show, maybe because it's in a more concentrated time space than you know the show was over more episodes. But there's some really great points in it. I mean, Tom Bennett again is absolutely brilliant. He plays his sort of, well, the only person in the office that kind of entertains Brent's humour, and he's brilliant. And there's a lovely new receptionist as well. I do think the way it's going, the end's quite predictable. Obviously won't say anything about that, but interestingly the beginning is basically exactly the same as Alpha Papa, which is really weird. Starts, doesn't give anything away, but it starts in a car with a song, and I feel like either that's a really niche joke or it's just someone should have flagged that because it's identical. But there are some really good songs in there. There's one about Slough which is genuinely hilarious, very very catchy, and then when it ends you'll just be feeling like it should be Christmas. We gave it 2 stars. I'd be slightly kinder and give it a low 3. But low 3. It's enjoyable.
A low recommendation.
Yeah.
But 2 stars is not a recommendation. But if you like, look at your face.
Yeah. It doesn't ruin The Office. And I think at the end of the day, that's all anyone could hope for. So
cool.
It's a little bit extra.
All right. 2 stars then for David Brent, Life on the Road. So next up is Swallows and Amazons. Helen, have at it.
Yeah, this is an adaptation of the 1930 novel by Arthur Ransome, which was probably on everybody's shelf growing up. And it's about a family of children, the Walkers, who are on holiday in the Lake District with their mother while their father, who is a ship's captain, is abroad. And it's just super charming, super nostalgic kind of a story. The four of them go sailing on the local lake. They go to a little island to camp out on the island. Their boat that they go sailing in is called the Swallow, so they call themselves the Swallows. And they get into a fight with a pair of kids, local kids, who also have a boat called the Amazon, and have laid claim to this island as their own. So there's a little bit of business between the two of them. But you also have Rafe Spall as a local man who is a kind of a 39 Steps-esque shady figure who's on the run from someone or something. There's a little bit of business on the train at the beginning of this. This is kind of an addition to the story of the novel, involving some spies who are after him for nefarious reasons. And is he a goodie or a baddie? We don't know. Probably a goodie. So you've got Andrew Scott as one of the people pursuing him as well. So there is a little bit of, they've added in a little bit of adventure and excitement to this kind of kid's story, but it is really a very nostalgic piece. Beautiful, beautiful kids' performances, gorgeous, gorgeous landscapes, great support from the likes of Kelly MacDonald and Jessica Hines, but really it's like watching one of those really, do you remember in if any of you were around in the 80s and 90s, the really classy half hour literary adaptations of kids books that the BBC used to do? Yeah. So The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, The Children of Green Know, The Box of Delights, all of those kind of ones. That's what this feels like, and not necessarily in a bad way. Yes, it is kind of twee and kind of nostalgic, but it's pretty well done, so you kind of let it away with stuff that you wouldn't otherwise lie. So I had a really nice time. We gave it 3 stars. I'm a little bit on the high end of that scale. Actually, I had a really nice time watching it, but it is definitely twee and it may well not be for you, in which case that's probably a fair rating.
There we go. 3 stars in for Swallows and Amazons. Sorry, we've got to race through this because once again we've overrun a little bit. We're being kicked out of the booth any second now, which means there's just time for one more review this week. And this is very interesting because it is A Childhood of a Leader, and this is a Metrodrome release, and as we understand it at the moment, it is still being released in cinemas this weekend. But just in case it isn't, you know, check listings before you go out, I would say. So, Emma.
Yeah, so The Childhood of a Leader is the feature-length debut from Brady Corbett. He's acted under sort of, you know, von Trier and Haneke, and this film definitely has echoes of that. It's set in...
And don't forget Thunderbirds.
And, sorry,
he was a lead in Thunderbirds, and I think that is the chief influence on his career.
Well, unfortunately, due to the lack of engineering prowess at that time in France in 1918, doesn't tie in too much to that, but it's set in the 1900s in France, and Liam Cunningham plays a US diplomat. Berenice Bayo is his wife, and they've got a young son, played by Tom Sweet. And Phil, who reviewed this for us, has described the film as Boyhood with Adolf, which, to be honest, is quite an apt description, because as his father is dealing with the sort of Versailles Treaty negotiations, the boy's sort of kicking off at home and throwing stones at priests and things that kind of spiral more and more out of control. And it's set in this partly fictitious world. So although the Versailles stuff is going on in the background and there's definitely a strong presence of war, what happens with the boy, you know, he's not, without spoiling anything, he's not a real figure. But as the title sort of says, it is The Childhood of a Leader, and it's split into chapters that are sort of each tantrum. So every chapter is, it focuses on, like I said, throwing the rocks at the priests and bigger tantrums. He kicks off with his nanny at one point, and then the lady that's trying to teach him, who's played by nymphomaniac Stacey Martin. And it's just got this real eerie feel. Everything about it just kind of, I can't describe it. It's like a real sticky feel to it. It's very creepy, and I completely fell in love with it. It's got this incredible score from Scott Walker, who's a 60s pop star that quite a lot of you may be aware of. Mm-hmm. And Lol Crawley, who recently did the cinematography on 45 Years, also works on this. And again, agreeing with Phil, it's got sort of like the shadowy elegance of a Rembrandt painting. It's a very dark film, but I honestly believe this personally to be the best film of the year for me so far.
Whoa.
Yeah, Civil War is my favourite, which I know is a complete contrast, but this for me so far I think is the best film of the year. It's crazy. Brady literally turned 28 yesterday, and this is his first film. And if you guys can go and see it, I honestly can't.
Brady,
Brady, I can't.
Braids, she calls him.
Braiders.
Braids. Bradders and Braids. Yeah, I saw it back in Edinburgh a few months ago, and I was just completely knocked for six. As soon as this really aggressive score starts, and it goes on for quite a while at the beginning, they have this sort of Pathé style montage of the end of World War One. It's all black and white, and the aspect ratio is a bit different, and it's a bit of a dreamy opening, really. And it just completely hooked me. It's a very simple story. It's just this growing up of a child, but just where it goes. It's got a really odd final act that I know won't sit right with a lot of people, but it's got these great performances across the board, and it's really nice to see Robert Pattinson doing something a bit different and quite still, and everyone's great in it. And you know, it's a really interesting take on a slightly fake but real part of history, really.
Awesome. So what did we give that?
We gave it 4, but I
sounds like you give it 3.
Be a big old 3. No, huge 5 stars from me.
A huge awesome. 5 stars.
Huge 5 stars.
For Brady Corbett, or yeah. I've always thought it was Corbet.
Brady, he always Brady Corbet.
Yeah, you have that sort of, I don't know, almost like Colbert.
Brady Corbett.
You know,
Colbert, yeah.
Yeah, Brady Corbet.
Okay.
Yeah, star of Thunderbirds. A movie that he's been trying to not make ever since.
And cool. He has succeeded.
And he has really succeeded. 4 stars then for that. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by... Todd Phillips.
Ooh.
Director of the Hangover trilogy with our good friend Bradders and War Dogs. In fact, Bradders is in that and he produced it as well. So there we go. Bradders isn't on the podcast though. He's just texting me to say he's unavailable.
Permanently, I think. It, like,
no, he didn't say that. He said, are you up for some lols late?
Nobody talks like that, Chris. I see through this.
I don't know what you mean. Until next week, it is goodbye from Emma.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from me. I'm off to re-edit every single Empire podcast and preface them with an apology. It's the only way to be sure. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.